Coming up today, planet Earth has a flag, but does it need one? Turtles have 3D printed metal jaws, but can they be trusted? And GCHQ has changed the rules on hacking, and should we be scared? All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from titanium turtles to vexillological deliberations. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Katie Collins.
And I'm Daniel Colpin.
Hi, Daniel.
Hello, Daniel.
Hello, how are you?
There's a new voice on the podcast this week.
Daniel is our resident intern here at Wired.co.uk. He's been with us a few months. We thought it would be time to introduce him to the glorious settings of our podcast recording studio. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very excited.
We have to explain, James is currently on location in Germany reporting for Wired.co.uk about the potential exit from the EU in Britain. And Liat is on holiday.
Yes, enjoying the fine high life that is Liat's holiday story. It continues.
She's in the New Forest.
Yeah.
But we're all very jealous still. But Daniel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Take a breath.
I will.
Consider where you are.
Psych myself up.
These are the moments that dreams are made of. And as is now becoming a tradition, I have a joke, a tech joke for everyone. This time, it comes from a reader, and we'll recognise them at the end of the show. But what did the computer do at lunchtime?
Tell us, Michael.
It had a bite. Oh, yeah. Oh, come on. Classic. Best one yet. Thanks for your laugh, listeners. I'll acknowledge them. That's all for now. Let's get on with the news. So to start on a serious note, Katie, this week there's been some surprising news coming from GCHQ surrounding the rules on hacking. Tell us about that.
That's right. So the news emerged earlier this week that claimed that the government had secretively made changes to anti-hacking laws and that have basically changed the way they apply to GCHQ. Now, this all came courtesy of Privacy International. And the organisation says it was notified of changes that were made to the Computer Misuse Act only hours ahead of an investigatory powers tribunal hearing that was supposed to be investigating its claim into GCHQ's illegal behaviour.
So the fear was that the change in the way these rules would be applied, or the change in the rules specifically, would impact on that tribunal.
That's right. And rather than kind of warning Privacy International that they changed the law or being kind of public about it, they were just basically informed only a few hours before they were due to go into court. And up until that point, the government had failed to respond to any of these claims about GCHQ's illegal behaviour, and this they remain completely silent on it. This was the first response that they'd given, and it was, "Oh, we've changed the law, by the way." So, what the Home Office did was that they responded to the claims that the law had been changed by saying, "There have been no changes made to the Computer Misuse Act by the Serious Crime Act that increase or expand the ability of the intelligence agencies to carry out lawful cybercrime investigation." So we've, on the one hand, we've got Privacy International saying the law's been changed, it's completely changed the way that that GCHQ and the other intelligence agencies can be prosecuted, and the Home Office saying that they haven't expanded the ability to hack and spy on us.
Well, it's a classic Home Office statement in that
it is.
It sounds like a denial, but it's actually very specific. So what they're saying is there haven't been changes made to a previous act by the new act that increase or expand its ability to do specific things.
Yeah, and the
key controversy is around the space in that definition.
The key words there are increase or expand. So, you know, if you look at the Act, you'll see that it's definitely been amended. Like, there has been a change to the law, and it does change the the kind of the legality of the intelligence agency's hacking activities. When I spoke to Eric King, who's the deputy director of Privacy International, he had this to say about it. He said, "Our view is that it changes the powers that the intelligence agencies have. We'd probably say expand, although I can imagine how the government felt comfortable saying it does not expand, depending on how you want to play legal weasel word games."
So what has changed?
So previously, Section 3 of the Computer Misuse Act stated that no one could impair the performance or quality of a computer unless it was their own computer. And this is the kind of law that they use to prosecute and go after people like Anonymous and other hacking collectives. But there was never any carve-out for the police, for law enforcement, for the intelligence agencies. You know, it applied to everyone across the board. And that was the basis on which Privacy was suing GCHQ. But the amendment clearly states that the law will now provide immunity to GCHQ staffers and law enforcement as long as the conduct was authorised.
So this is an exception for GCHQ that wasn't previously built into the legislation?
Exactly. And the reason that that we're saying that it's been secretive is that rather than debating this in the House of Commons, as you would do for primary legislation, this was passed as delegated legislation, and it was kind of hidden in other changes that were being made, you know, for a whole different variety of crimes. And it was kind of just this small amendment that was hidden in there.
So this is obviously a complex and subtle change, but the chap you spoke to from Privacy International had quite a good analogy.
He did. He said that taking legal action against GCHQ has become like playing croquet with the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland. Rules are changed as you play, which I thought was a fantastic quote and really, really sums up the situation that Privacy and the other agencies and organisations that are pursuing these claims against GCHQ now find themselves in and have found themselves in already. You know, that as they go along, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal will sometimes rule in their favour and say, yes, these activities were illegal, but the government's response is then to change the law to make those actions legal now that it's all kind of out in the open and that we know about it. And it's a really tricky kind of idea that as well that they're able to change the legislation and make these caveats, carve out these little amendments for GCHQ and intelligence agencies without it being publicly debated, without us necessarily knowing about it as well. I find that quite worrying.
Yeah, I feel the same. I think privacy, it's such a big issue of our time. The idea that these things can be smuggled through the legislation, it's not really even debated.
And but that's true. I mean, it generally, most polls say whatever your personal opinion on this kind of hacking or spying or whatever you could call it, most people are actually in favour of it as long as they're transparent about what they're doing and what their powers are.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the shifting around the edges without necessarily telling anyone that seems more insidious. Whatever you think about actually gathering that data or that intelligence and how they use it, it's not being clear and open about the boundaries of that I think really upsets people, particularly in the US, but more so here. The more we learn about what GCHQ is doing,
yeah. Well, I mean, as far as I know, Privacy are now going to continue pursuing this case, but the Investigatory Powers Tribunal may decide that while the activities of GCHQ historically were illegal, that you know it's not necessarily going to be illegal from now on, and therefore there might be very little that they can do about it.
Speaking of changing the rules as we go along. One of the most fundamental rules of the ocean is that turtles are not made of metal. But that rule may be changing, Daniel.
Yes, it may. This is a brilliant story. It's kind of a combination of the Discovery Channel and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, I think. basically, a sea turtle was seriously injured in a boating collision in Turkey. Now, a loggerhead sea turtle, they live for more than 50 years. They're kind of found across the world's oceans, but they are an endangered species. So they're often caught in boating accidents and kind of other man-made accidents, collisions. Basically, this turtle was found. It had its jaw completely shattered. It had been hit by a propeller. So as you can imagine, it was in a pretty bad state. But it was found and taken to Pamukkale University's Sea Turtle Research, Rescue and Rehabilitation Centre. Basically, it was unable to eat on its own because of its injury. So it looked very unlikely that the turtle, which was given the quite strange name of Akut 3, which sounds slightly...
Sounds like a robot.
Terminator-ish.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get there in the story, but it does look quite like a bit like a robot.
Yes, it's a very fitting name in the end. But anyway, Akut 3 was taken to the rehabilitation centre. It looked like it probably wouldn't go back into the wild because of its injuries. It couldn't feed itself. However, the university came up with a kind of ingenious collaboration. There's a company called BTech Innovation, who are based in Turkey. They're a biotechnology company who specialise in 3D medical prosthetics. Basically, they spent a few months kind of researching and developing a new solution to basically save Akut 3, which was a 3D titanium jaw.
That's amazing. So how did they even start to go about this? Because I imagine there was lots of scanning involved.
Yes, there was a kind of CT scans and kind of computer software was used to kind of create a 3D model of the turtle's beak. And from there on, they were basically able to design a prosthetic replacement, which they used a 3D printer to make in medical grade titanium. Now, this is quite big. I mean, it was the first time this surgery had ever been performed. So I imagine it was quite kind of touch and go for a while. Apparently, it took 2.5 hours to carry out by kind of surgeons and vets in the hospital.
And what do we know about the status currently of Akut 3? Obviously, he's now a world celebrity because this story was the most read on the BBC. I think at one point it was top of Google News when I was checking. Maybe that's just my personal preferences. And it did, you know, a lot of people read it on our site. So what is the status of this turtle?
Well, it seems that he's doing okay. He's still recovering, apparently. But one of the vets who actually carried out the operation said that its body showed no signs of rejecting the titanium jaw, which obviously is a big worry that the its body wouldn't accept it and the implant would be rejected. So, given his post-op examination, it looks like Akut 3 might carry on his kind of media spotlight.
And the plan is to release him back into the ocean?
Oh, wow.
Yes, that's the plan. Basically, the jaw enables it to hunt and feed for itself.
Yeah.
So, yes, I guess. I'm not sure how long it will take, whether it will be kind of weeks or months, but they should be able to send him off out into the wild again. And
it sounds like he'll also have to learn how to eat again, because I mean, if you think about the weight of a titanium jaw, it must be quite different to the weight and the feel of his normal jaw, and you know, he won't have as much feeling in it, so.
But he will look a lot cooler.
Yeah,
he looks
of course.
Very cool.
So the other turtles will back off from the food because he looks so cool. I mean, it's true that we've done on Wired and there are other tech sites that do them, several stories around animals with 3D printed appendages. There was definitely a dolphin, which had a 3D printed fin, I think. Yeah. I think we did a story about a tortoise.
Cleopatra.
Yes. You know the name.
Cleopatra, the 3D printed shell, yes.
So it's increasingly, there are a number of animals out there with 3D printed bits. This is just the coolest looking, as far as it's just a very cool picture. I encourage everyone to go on the website and take a look at it. But his jaw, it looks just like a Terminator.
It's like, brilliant.
It's incredible. But well, we wish Akut 3 the best as a team.
Yes.
If he'd like to visit us,
yeah,
once he's well, we'll gladly welcome him to the office. He can be a guest on the podcast.
Yes.
In other good news for Earth, the planet has a flag. It's possible that in the next few decades we might make it to Mars. And Oscar Pernevelt of the Beckmans College of Design in Stockholm took it on himself to design the flag. He worked with organisations including NASA, Nike, various design groups to put together his new design, which is essentially, I think, 7 interlocking rings forming what someone pointed out to me is a non-symmetrical flower on a blue background. It looks similar to what you would imagine the UN flag to be, but obviously it's abstract. It shows the interlocking continents on an ocean of blue. But he put together, his trick really was that he put together some very good concept art. So his artwork, which is obviously on the website, shows the flag being waved at the World Cup, being planted on Mars by the aforementioned astronaut, being on the uniform of the astronaut as they do a spacewalk. It just looks lovely.
So he's managed to persuade everyone, because of his concept art, that this should be the flag for Earth. Are we going to be able to vote on this? Is it going to be a democratic decision? Or has he just cast himself in the role of the Earth's flag maker and we've all kind of gone along with it?
It's very much a dictatorship in terms of vexillological design. But, you know, I think it's a nice concept. But what I think it showed is, and again, this is one of those stories like Akut 3, the sea turtle, that provoked a lot of discussion on social media for us, and people responded to the idea. But as you found out, subsequent to the design, I asked you to look into the past of Earth flags, and there have been many attempts.
Yes, some really interesting attempts out there. Some by kind of, a lot of them are by kind of peace activists or people with slightly hippie-ish inclinations. And, you know, you mentioned the UN flag. Some people would argue that we already do have a world flag in the form of the UN flag. There's also been an attempt to create a world flag by stitching together all of the other flags that we've already got for the existing countries and also the UN flag, and kind of arranging them, you know, and it's quite colourful. It's quite, you know, it's not as iconic really as a lot of those, as like the UN flag is, or, and the majority of flags out there kind of work based on the same premise. So they look at taking the Earth, maybe the Sun, and the moon, and using they all use the colour blue. Blue is a very popular
well, the Earth is blue.
Yeah.
You can see where they're coming from.
And so, I mean, some of the most interesting ones. So there was a very famous photograph called Blue Marble, which was taken by NASA from space, I think in the 1970s. And so this very famous photograph it's been proposed as, you know, the flag. Should we just have a photograph of the blue marble as a representation of who we are? And in a way that kind of makes sense, because if you're going to put this flag on Mars or on another planet, and you're going to want to be able to put it in context somehow. Say you were another species from another galaxy arriving on Mars, you know, you'd be able to say, oh, look, I can see that. Like, when we're flying through space, we can see, you know, we know who to equate that flag with. It's, it kind of makes sense.
I think in the context of Mars, the blue is good. It can contrast nicely with the iron atmosphere, you know, the iron surface. I think it looks nice. But I don't know. I think one of these days we're going to end up in a galactic Olympics. Right.
Yeah.
And this sets a dangerous precedent. Do we want our uniforms to be blue, or do we want them to be red? And there was a study this week which showed that red is the most successful colour for sports teams to wear because of various associations with aggression, I think, and the effect it has on your opponent.
Interesting.
I think as Earth, we could look at red as an alternate colour, maybe a kind of a reddy brown, because most of the land is brown from space.
Yes.
But, I just think pink maybe would be a nice offbeat colour. If we're going to make this decision, we've got to make it right. That's all I'm saying. And do we want to leave it to a student in Stockholm? Or do we want some kind of global vote?
Well, I think it has to be some kind of democratic process. It seems that it's going to be a kind of world flag, then we should all have some say.
Yeah, but if we do that, Beyonce is going to end up on the flag.
Well, she does rule the world.
Well, Pernevelt gave a nice quote about the flag. He said, the blue field represents water, which is essential for life. Also, as the oceans cover most of our planet's surface, the flower's outer rings form a circle which could be seen as a symbol of Earth as a planet, and the blue surface could represent the universe.
That's very airy-fairy, isn't it?
It is. It's a nice project.
It is a nice project, Oscar.
But I don't know. We asked on Twitter for some of your designs. A couple of people sent in some a little bit more cynical than Oscar's vision of the blue Earth and the harmony it represents. But if you do have flag designs of your own, feel free to send them in. We'd be interested to see them. But, so there's no current prospect of this flag becoming a design standard for the Earth.
Yeah.
But, you know, we live in hope that we kind of get together. And if we're going to have a world government and a world democracy, then the first thing I think we should vote on is our flag. So watch this space. Finally, in the news, in a new section for the podcast, we're just going to briefly talk about, in 15-second hits, some of our favourite links and videos of the week. So a couple from me. The first trailer for the Steve Jobs movie was launched, I think, on Monday. It looks ridiculous. Michael Fassbender looks nothing like Steve Jobs, but could still be a good film. There's also a very good video produced by researchers at Google, which is able to take photos from Flickr and automatically turn them into time lapses over very long periods of time. And it's dramatic. You can see buildings rising and falling. And I would recommend seeking that out on our website, too. We also have a quiz this week.
It's such a fun quiz. And Michael's going to be very humble about this now, probably. But he designed a quiz and I didn't do very well on it. But I recommend that you all have a go and see if you can beat my measly 38%.
Mine was worse. Mine's 30%.
I should explain what this quiz is. This is MPs were provided, as they are at the start of every parliament, with a 200-page document explaining the world. Including 6 pages on technology. And this is stuff they're supposed to learn and know in case anyone asks them, which you think might be the kind of thing you would provide an MP before they're elected, but apparently not. Anyway, we have a quiz, 13 things MPs should know about technology, and you can compare yourself to them. There is no quiz in the podcast this week, but that is returning next week. So in the meantime, do your research and revision on our website.
I've got to say, I'm a little relieved.
Anything else anyone's seen online this week?
I've spotted the things that I've been looking at are kind of design stories, actually. We've got a really cool gallery up of all the winners of the London Architecture Awards. And there are some incredible designs up there. And if you're actually in London this week and you want to see something pretty cool, there's an Airbnb house that's floating up and down the Thames. You can go and take a look at. We've got a story about it on our website, and some images from actually inside the house as well. But you know, it's quite a cool little thing that Airbnb have done to celebrate the Deregulation Act in London.
Cool. Also a potential way to increase the housing stock in London, which is desperately needed.
Yes.
Just take to the Thames.
You can spend a night there, can't you, as well?
Isn't
there a competition?
That's right, yeah.
Should be quite cool, yeah. Floating up and down there.
Daniel, have you found anything online this week?
I was quite interested in Tim Cook's commencement speech, George Washington University. It's kind of part Apple marketing pitch.
Of course.
Part kind of inspirational, graduate and be brilliant speech. But it was interesting because it obviously had echoes of Steve Jobs' very famous address.
Yeah, I was going to say it's unfortunate maybe for Tim Cook is been up stage once more. Steve Jobs famously gave an incredible commencement speech, which is oft quoted and often seen as his most human moment in public.
Yeah. Well, he does pay homage to Steve Jobs in the speech as well, and talks about the ways in which Steve Jobs inspired him and kind of got him on board with Apple and changed his thinking about basically everything. So, you know, it's actually quite touching in that respect. So, you know, go and check that out too.
That's all the news this week. Still to come, Spotify wants to create music for you as you run, but how far from the perfect running companion are we? All that and more coming up.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
So Katie, this week you covered the press conference by Spotify in which they announced a variety of new features, video, podcasting, they have discovered and are now part of Spotify, yes. But also some interesting running stuff.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things that Daniel Ek, Spotify CEO, said on stage was that one of the aims of these new changes to Spotify was to create better experiences. And while this sounded quite vague, he actually gave a really good example of how Spotify intends to do this by introducing a new running feature into the app, which it sounds really interesting, and it's a way of Spotify using that kind of 8 years of data they've got now of people listening to music in different situations and creating playlists and actually using that to feedback and create something for Spotify users. And what they've done is that they've looked at the kind of songs that people like running to, and they've collated all of that information, and they've also looked at the different kind of tempos of all of the different songs, and they've kind of matched that with the ability that exists within your smartphone's sensors. And as you run, your smartphone will kind of pick up the pace at which you're running, and Spotify will then kind of feed you songs that will match your running pace, so you can kind of get that boom 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 as you run and your feet hit the pavement.
Well, this is one of the things from the press. It was a weird press conference.
It was a really,
it was really
weird,
strange press conference. But as you said, some of the news was very cool. But it does occur, you know, they promote this with videos of people like running very aggressively and bang bang bang, and everyone's listening to Tiesto or whatever. But like, so if you slow down, as I did during the marathon recently, what happens? Does it just become like,
so the algorithm,
slow desperate ballads,
white noise,
the algorithm can adjust to your pace as you're running. So, you know, it can takes around 5 seconds to realize. I don't think it will just change the track automatically, but right. The next track that I think it lines up. And the other thing that they've done is that they've done some research into the kind of music, that how music makes people feel as they run, and they've tried to pinpoint songs that either make people feel like a hero in their, that was a quote from them, okay, or make them feel like a feather. And I can understand what this means, because, you know, there are some songs when you're running, as a runner, you kind of get this sense of like, you know, the song is almost kind of lifting you and like making you feel a certain way, and it's all obviously psychological, but it makes you feel like you're running better and that you're having a kind of better running experience.
So these songs, it's like six initial tracks, right? And they will reconfigure themselves.
That's right. So they've worked with some musicians to create these bespoke music tracks that will, you know, that can be played at different varying speeds, so that you won't need to worry about what your pace is in order to listen to these while you're running. The algorithm can adjust the speed of the track. And I think one of the partners that they kind of pulled up on stage was Tiesto. I'm not sure, I've seen Tiesto play in Las Vegas, and while I'm sure many people do like his music, it's not really for me. So I'm hoping that there's more of a variety of these kind of
running music, though. It's quite kind of,
yeah,
you know,
it is.
Boom, boom.
Yeah. And I think that's another thing, you know, a lot of the music people listen to when they run, they don't necessarily listen to in everyday life as they're going about their business. But yeah, what do you think of this, Michael? You've just run a marathon.
Well, you know, I don't know. I hate giving up more control to Spotify to their playlists rather than the music I actually choose to listen to. Sort of instinctively, that feels wrong. Like, I like radio as much as anyone else, but the obsession with just listening to their curated music doesn't quite get me. But I do like the idea of something of a running audio system that can keep your tempo up through the run. I mean, I listen to rock and metal basically when I run. Andrew WK, as I've mentioned several times in this podcast, yeah, but other stuff too. But, you know, it is one of those things where I'm constantly searching through tracks while I'm running to try and keep that pace up. Or there are certain songs that have peaks, and then after that peak, you just drop right off a cliff because you were running along to that pace. So I think this sounds really neat. But, you know, for me, running with Spotify doesn't quite make sense because I have an enormous phone. So
yeah.
I can't run with Spotify. But I think there's something in it. I think it just kind of remains to be seen how it's going to work for Spotify specifically. But, you know, Apple is entering this market, we presume, in a few weeks with its relaunch of Beats. Obviously, Google has its long-standing music. I think they would do well to look at this and learn something. You know, because, like you said, people don't listen to albums as much as they used to, but people listen to a lot of music, and exercise is one of those places that people do listen to music and are looking for new ways to to do that. And so it does make sense.
It does make me wonder, though, whether any service could do this, or whether, I mean, Spotify owns a huge proportion of the streaming market now, and it has so much data on people, and it's really pouring all that data back into creating these better experiences. But, you know, the other services out there don't necessarily have all that data. And the other thing you were saying, you know, you like to run to rock and metal and that kind of thing. The Spotify will realise that that's your genre, and, you know, won't provide you with a load of music that isn't the kind of music that you like, because it's learned about you over the years, or however long that you've been a Spotify member. It knows what kind of music you like to listen to. And I think having that knowledge, it's one of those situations where you feel like handing your data over is worthwhile, because you're really getting something in return from it. You know, you're getting that personalized experience. Whether any of those rival services are at the stage where they could equal that, I don't know.
Daniel, are you a runner?
Well, fleetingly. I tend to choose really dodgy kind of German trance techno music that's just kind of, you know, 120 BPM or something, and fail miserably at keeping up with the pace. I don't really know what I think about it. I'm in two minds. I mean, I think if they choose the music well, and again, as Katie was saying, it kind of, you know, picks the music based on your habits and kind of listening habits long term, it could work. But I quite like choosing my own music, and it can differ. I mean, sometimes I will kind of just listen to kind of classical or podcasts as well, so it's not always, you know, I'm not always listening to the same thing.
I think that's a good point. Like, often when you're running, good music pops into your head in the moment, or, you know, it's on shuffle and something pops up you wouldn't have thought to listen to when running. Like, I've had runs listening to Blonde on Blonde, you know, the classic Bob Dylan album. Not a running album,
not the obvious choice.
But if it's sunset and you're in the right kind of mood, it's great. And I there is something of this which is slightly robotic, like the idea of just turning on this pre-configured adjustable track for 20 minutes and just kind of running without thinking about it. Like, maybe misses out some of the fun emotion of listening to music as you run.
I think that is part of what Spotify is trying to echo, though, with this system. So you know that you mentioned before, sometimes you're listening to a song and, like, you're running along and you feel great, and then it's the song stops, it switches to another track, and, like, you sort of feel like you fall off a cliff, like everything kind of goes flat. And what it's trying to do is find the tracks that will keep you elevated, and that, you know, from song to song will prolong that feeling. And if they can do that, if they can, you know, really alter your mood in a really positive way that enhances your running, then I think people will love it.
They claimed that running with music can have, I think they said, a 15% boost on, I'm not sure what the metric they said was. I think it was something like the effectiveness of your run. I don't know what that means. I mean, the science of that is still out as well, right? I mean, like, most people listen to music when they run, but often I find it can be a distraction, or can be something that artificially makes you run more quickly than you should, and then you burn out halfway through a run, or I don't know. There's something about pacing, maybe, that they're not really considering.
It's true, sometimes you need a change of pace. If you had an entire playlist of kind of, you know, Matt Tiesto or something, that might not be, you know, you might burn out within the first 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there's a bigger question about Spotify as a whole. I mean, as I mentioned, they are now incorporating podcasts and some video content into the service, clearly making a play to be a broader media service. But it's hard to know exactly what their end game is here. I mean, you watch the press conference. Do you get the sense they're trying to take on YouTube or trying to take on Netflix? Or what is their end game, do you think? Because clearly streaming music is going to be their bread and butter for a very long time.
So the sense that I got was they're not really trying to compete with YouTube, as far as I can tell. It's closer to, given the amount of content partners that they announced, like really high profile content partners, all credit to them for getting all of those companies on board before announcing this. But it's more seems to be taking on the Netflix model, I suspect. But one of the things that they were emphasizing was short clips of content. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's what they focus on initially, at least, you know, people that want a couple of minutes of video of something funny or something newsworthy, or so they are, I think they're kind of treading a middle ground between some of the more professional content that's on YouTube and the kind of stuff that the really professional level of comedy and that kind of thing that you get on Netflix. But I suspect in the long run, it's going to want to be the kind of streaming service that you can access everything that you want to within that one app.
Podcasting seems like one of the obvious places in digital media that needs some thinking about in terms of the apps people use and the services people use. Mm. Obviously, we are a podcast. You, our listeners, are listening somewhere. A lot of people listen on the web. Some people listen in the default podcasting app in iOS, or there isn't one in Android, but you know, there are services like Pocket Casts and others. But you know, to integrate podcasts within Spotify or you know Beats Music or whatever iTunes becomes seems like a natural thing. I mean, podcasts are very mainstream now, and yet we're kind of still relying on these, often on these third-party networks or search tools or apps that don't really have a great experience. So I find myself having to flip between Pocket Casts and Google Music and Spotify all the time. It would be nice to have it in one place.
Yeah, I agree. And although you say podcasts are mainstream these days, and I think over the last year in particular, there's been a huge growth in the number of people listening to podcasts, but I still don't think it's actually anywhere near as many people, you know, as should be listening to podcasts or who would want to. But I think part of the problem is actually just discovering that content. And you know, if Spotify is the means by which it's actually placing this content in front of a much much wider audience who naturally would be interested in many of the podcasts out there and would want to listen to them, then I think this is going to be a great thing for podcasting as well.
Condé Nast was listed as one of the partners in the Spotify content announcement, although we have no idea.
Yes, Daniel Ek actually mentioned Wired on stage, and obviously that you know there's Wired in the US as well, but this was news to us. But hopefully, you know, it'd be great to see the Wired podcast on Spotify and many others. We're podcast fans as well, so and I'm always telling more people that they should be listening to podcasts, so it'd be good to see that.
Yeah, it's just going to be fun to see what Spotify turns into in 5 or 10 years. Mm. Daniel, do you have any hunches on where Spotify might go? Or just...
Well, for me personally, I guess I came quite late to podcasts. It's only recently I've kind of, started becoming quite addicted to them. And I think they're quite addictive once you start listening to them. But I think if Spotify does this well, and like you said, there are so many platforms out there, I kind of personally find it a bit bewildering knowing kind of where to go. Sometimes it's SoundCloud or kind of, you know, like third-party apps like you mentioned, Michael. So I think it would be great if they could kind of corner the market on this and have kind of a go-to place where you could find podcasts from a range of different topics, subjects. I think that would really, I think that would kind of break new ground and would really appeal to quite a lot of people.
They just need maybe someone to plan their press conferences a little bit more effectively.
Yes.
It's very weird.
They also definitely needed some quality control on there. Perhaps somebody with a comic touch to help them with those funny moments that they were clearly going for, but
it's
didn't
funny
quite
you say that,
make.
Because you know, people have told me I'm a very funny guy, and as you well know, jokes are now a part of this podcast. I'm available, Spotify, you know, just for some light relief.
I saw Spotify could always do the awful Tidal thing, you know, hijack a load of celebs, get them on a stage and kind of do some kind of circus type, you know.
It did do that a little bit, but not quite to the same extent. There's always been a bit of an interesting dynamic between Spotify and its musical partners. So, some musicians love Spotify, and you know they've done some really interesting things using Spotify, and Spotify has actually really helped certain musicians' careers. You know, really helped them take off, whereas other musicians, Taylor Swift, for example.
Of course, she pulled everything off.
And Radiohead as well, being very outspoken about Spotify. And you know, I think it really depends. It's clearly not working for all musicians, is what I would say.
Well,
right
to
now.
Give credit to another tech website, The Verge had a good story this week in which they had exclusive access and indeed published a copy of Sony Music's original contract with Spotify. I don't think it's, from the wording, it may not be the current contract, but it's really worth reading their story because it gives an interesting insight into the complexity of how Spotify makes money, but more pertinently, how Sony makes money from Spotify.
Yeah.
And it's not just as simple as, you know, a revenue share, or you count up all the streams and then you get a certain amount of money. There's a lot of bartering that goes on, a lot of complex negotiation. And I think in regard to Apple's entry into the market when they relaunched Beats, as we presume that will happen at WWDC, there's a lot of talk about, have they got the deals in place? Are they going to happen? And by reading this document, you really get a sense of how complex that process is, and if it doesn't happen, why? And so it's like an interesting piece of context in a week that's otherwise kind of big and sparkly for Spotify, with lots of fun announcements.
And if you're interested in that kind of area of music and the relationship between musicians and their record labels and streaming partners from all over the internet, you should also read our cover story from a few months ago that's now online about Cobalt. She's a very interesting music business. I think we called it the most important music business you haven't heard of, or something similar to that. But I would definitely give that a read, because that really opened my eyes to, you know, how artists can be really empowered actually by the streaming movement.
I think Skrillex is interviewed, isn't he?
Yes, that's right.
It's quite an interesting kind of insider's view of how he's benefited from.
Yeah,
it's a great story. You can find it on wired.co.uk. Just time for some feedback now. This comes from Sebastian from Edinburgh. He writes, I've been listening since episode 97 and have also enjoyed the recent additional episodes, as once a week was not enough. Oh, thanks, Sebastian. We've got some more additional episodes, I think, coming up in the next 2 or 3 weeks, so look out for those, in addition to your regular Wired podcast, of course. He goes on, praises aside, oh dear, following your talk about fake animal mummies, this is in relation to a story we discussed last week, Katie, in which ancient Egyptians were found to be not necessarily mummifying real animals.
No.
there was an element of fakery in ancient Egypt and its mummification process. Well, I mentioned a story which related to the modern cremation of animal pets and the controversy around that. And he just wanted to point us to the Freakonomics podcast episode, The Troubled Cremation of Stevie the Cat, where they investigate exactly this case of fake pet cremations. I'd mentioned a New Yorker article on this subject, and Sebastian's absolutely right. It's not a New Yorker article, it's a Freakonomics podcast, so you can find that on the web. He also just wanted to add a quick comment about articles being published directly on Facebook's pages. It's a little bit of a chicken or egg situation, he writes, in that, sure, a huge amount of people on Facebook, and it can be in different content providers' interest to publish their articles there, but it's also true that it's in Facebook's interest to have good quality content directly on its pages. People who provide content for a living, that would be us guys, tend to be better at it. I agree. So they are crucial in providing good content, and if they are a high profile source like the New York Times or Wired for that matter, then that content will also be easier to find. So positives and negatives, I think that's kind of roughly where we came down on it with Facebook instant articles. I should also just credit Sebastian for the joke at the top of this podcast.
Oh, well, thanks Sebastian for enhancing the comedy of the Wired podcast.
Yeah, just think, Sebastian, of the joy you just brought to thousands of people. And, you know, that's an amazing thing. So anyway, thank you for that. Anything else, guys?
No, all I would say is I would recommend that people keep their eyes on the site, because James is, as we mentioned at the start of the show, in Germany this week, and he's finding out some really interesting things about both about German innovation and also, you know, looking at the future of the UK's relationship with Germany.
That's true.
Pending the EU referendum.
Yeah, James actually broke a story. I think it's the first quote from an MD of a German industrial company who said they won't invest in the UK until the referendum is decided. A fairly significant story. You can find that and all of his articles from Germany on wired.co.uk. So that's all from us. Until next week, goodbye.
Cheerio.
Bye.